said to myself, self, what music would be appropriate for our conversation with David Roth? So, of course, this came to mind. David Roth from Defector.com and, of course, the co-host of the Distraction Podcast joins us. Hello, David.
How's it going? I've not been told that I inspired James Brown-style emotions in people very often. Usually bloggers seldom hear that. So that's really meaningful to me, Rich. Thank you.
Oh, happy. Happy I could do that for you this afternoon. You're just back from your visit to Maine, and I loved your description of Maine on the Distraction, and I think this is perfect. Rocky coasts, older men in overalls.
Yeah, you get both. Very few places can do both. I got to see a little bit of both of those things. This was more of a sort of a business trip than a vacation. We were up to see my father-in-law, and he's retired, a retired Portland fireman who now does antique stuff. A lot of that now involves just compiling massive amounts of things that he gets at the transfer stations all across Hancock County. So there was a lot of moving of boxes and some light scrap metal moving involved, which was good. It was like a sort of a extremely exurban version of CrossFit. So I came back feeling lean and toned and grateful to have had a little bit of an opportunity to do stuff like that, but not too much.
Yeah, it's nice to feel like you're helping out.
Yeah, and in this case, it's like he is a passionate guy about stuff. He knows a lot about it. He's very interested in it. He's just way more interested in getting than in selling it. And so my wife and I were trying to, he's starting, opening a little shop on Deer Isle, where he lives, and we helped him get some stuff set up. I think it's going to be very nice. It's just also, you know, this is one of the great things about Maine to me, is that like every book that has ever entered the state is still in the state and for sale in various stages of degradement. And that is like, he's got some that are at the very end of their lives, but then there's also, you know, like, I guess it's a state that reads. Like every transfer station that we went to had like the equivalent of a great free paperback bookstore in it. Like you can get a lot of like, you know, Sean Hannity books, but I also picked up at the transfer station in Surrey, Maine, a copy of Klaus Kinski's autobiography, which was like so crazy that it was instantly out of print. So it's wild that such a thing ever made it up there in the first place, and now I have it.
Well, see, if you got it in Surrey, that's close enough. That's close enough to where John Hodgman hangs out that I bet he left it there.
It probably, you know, we actually had that thought because we, the second time that we went back there, this is what, I'm happy to do dump chat the whole time if you want, by the way. This is way better than anything else I got on my mind. The second time that we went by there, somebody who had a very good collection of, like, contemporary fiction was clearly just, you know, realizing that they needed more space for other stuff. And so if it turns out that I have, like, John Hodgman's collection of, like, every novel that Joshua Ferris wrote that he abruptly decided he didn't want anymore, like, it would be my honor. Also, it wouldn't surprise me that much.
Wow. Now, I wonder if this is just coincidence. Several reports that Mike Wolfe of American Pickers was in Down East Maine this past weekend.
Really?
Yeah.
That is something that my father-in-law would be extremely excited to know about. He doesn't watch that much TV. I mean, I know he knows the American Pickers guys, but he's got a whole series of like YouTube channels that he watches. He seems to have sort of cracked the algorithm such that he's the one person that can watch YouTube for 5 hours and he's not getting recommended Ben Shapiro videos or like things that are trying to turn him fascist. Like they've just figured out that what he wants is a video where a bunch of guys, with metal detectors go into a bog and talk about what they find. And he'll just watch that endlessly. And it's kind of, you know, as things that you could find online go, like there's sure a lot less wholesome stuff than that.
Now, did he watch, my in-laws were very excited for me to watch this. It's sort of the main version of American Pickers. I think it was only on for a season or two, something called Down East Dickering.
Yeah. He knew about it. Down East Dickering sounds like you know, the skit that gets cut from an episode of Saturday Night Live.
Right.
But like, you know, at rehearsal, they're like, no one understands what you're saying, man. The accents are too much. I'm afraid that we're going to have to remove it from show. But I know that Down East Dickering was real. And that was basically I mean, it was what it sounds like, right? It was like going to yard sales and being like, I'm interested in this aluminum that you've got, but not at this price. And then they just figure it out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was, yes, it was American Pickers with guys who talked like Tom Bosley in Murder, She Wrote.
That's a real winning elevator pitch. Like, I'm willing to commit to another couple of seasons just on my own dime now. I'd like to be able to shoot it, though.
Well, apparently the Pickers are coming back in the fall, so tell your dad to keep an eye open this October.
Yeah, I think that this is, you know, like, that part of the season would be when it would be good to sort of come through, because I think we were there, so this is the earliest that we've been up in what, like, sort of qualifies as the summer season. So most of the time that we were up there, there really weren't, a lot of places were closed, and there weren't, you know, as much of a presence of, you know, sort of tourists as I imagine will be the case during the summer. But it seems like there's going to be a lot of people around there. Like, ambiently, like, all the people that we talked to, and certainly, like, you know, like Wally and all of his buddies and stuff, that it seems like maybe this is a bounce back vacation season for the state. I mean, I know we did our part, but I mean, just in terms of clearing shelf space at the dump, mostly, we didn't really buy that much.
Well, I was down on MDI this past weekend to see my in-laws, and yeah, it sure seemed like there were a lot of out-of-state license plates. A whole lot of folks were back, so that's a good thing.
Where were you on Mount Desert?
Somesville.
I wonder if we were there around the same time. I was in Winter Harbor.
Ah, other side, Somesville, which is the, I guess they call the quiet side of the island over near Southwest Harbor.
Yeah, it's cool. I'm glad that we got to do that. The only reason we got to go to Acadia Head Hall was that our flight got canceled out of Bangor going back. And so it was, you know, I was grumpy about it because I had to work on Sunday and I didn't want to have to do that from the house, you know, with my father-in-law and my wife around. Like, I had, but mostly I was just grumpy sort of in the way that one would be when a flight gets canceled. And then it just occurred to me, it's like, well, that's like a whole free day in Maine. Like, and we didn't need to drive to the airport back either. So we were like, why don't we just do something that we like, Ben, which is go, basically we go to Acadia so that my wife can go to the Dairy Queen in Ellsworth. But there is, you know, like, there's some other steps to it that are nice and scenic, but it's important that we go to the Dairy Queen.
Well, you must have earned some pretty solid son-in-law points for all this heavy lifting.
I like to think I did. I don't know. I mean, I did my best. Like, but I think that there is, like, that's part of the gig. It's the part of it that I have always sort of liked. I mean, it, certainly, I don't know how many more years, like, I've got as the, like, passably young person in any of these scenarios, but, like, it's a lot easier for me to go up and down stairs repeatedly than it is for my father-in-law or for my own parents. So, yeah, being able to be the person that's willing to, you know, carry one of those big plastic totes full of garbage that needs to be priced. Like, you know, I like to think that I'm banking those points for later. I don't know when I'm going to need to redeem them. I'm sure I'll figure out something annoying to do. And then I'll be like, do you remember the time that I helped you carry that broken desk to your car? Maybe I'll get some points out of that.
We're talking with David Roth here on Downtown. I want to bring up a little sports here. Your piece on Andrew McCutchen and furries was fascinating to me. And what is it? Anthrocon? Good Lord.
Yeah. So this was something that this was the post that I did on Sunday from up there. So every year around this time, around July 4th, there is a massive furry convention in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, of all places. And apparently Pittsburgh is really warm to it. The furries love it. But it is big enough that every year when it happens, if the Pirates are at home, the visiting baseball team winds up in a hotel with people who are dressed as, like, whimsical unicorns or sort of weirdly sexualized foxes. Like, it's a very strange convention. And apparently it's, like, pretty wholesome in its way, or at least, you know, the public-facing part of it is wholesome. But it's not necessarily, like, what, you know, like, Mike Matheny is not built to be near that. You know what I mean? There's certain guys that are just shouldn't be exposed to it. And so every year when McCutchen, you know, was a star in Pittsburgh and then has been back as a visitor, every time he is there when the furry convention is happening, he just tweets the word furries without any explanation. He's now done it three times. He did it on Saturday of last week. And it's like kind of in its own way, like a tradition of his. Like there's no other comment. Like he's not ever followed it up and been like, are disgusting, or like, I am one of them. He just leaves it out there and people react to it. But in putting that post together, I got the occasion to go back and look at the times that the convention has been mentioned by broadcasters who also wind up at these hotels. And there were two. There's one that I remembered, which was during a Mets broadcast, Keith Hernandez and Gary Cohen talking about it. Keith Hernandez being like, they smelled so bad I had to get off the elevator before my stop. Like this was, it was not negative, but it was very visceral. And then I found one that I didn't know about, which is in 2007 at the very beginning of a Brewers Pirates game. So that like the Brewers are up. This is the visiting half of the first. Right off the bat, Bob Uecker is like, so the furry convention is here this weekend. And just, it's 15 minutes of Bob Uecker free associating while the color commentator guy periodically asks scandalized questions. Some of it is Uecker being extremely, even-handed and sort of, you know, like, he's not making fun of it necessarily. But then he slips in these bizarre deadpan gags that are, I guess I had sort of forgotten just how great Bob Uecker is. But, like, the character that he is in Major League, I think he just does that on the air every Brewers game.
Right, I think it's just without the booze. That's the only difference.
Right, which is, yes, that he's, like, actually coming by it honestly. The bit that I remember from his monologue when he was talking about the convention was he was, like, laying out some of the actual stuff that they were doing, you know, and he's like, you know, so all the Wolves will be there and they'll all be together and that's really great for them. You know, there's some different workshops. There's a banquet, I believe, that is catered by Purina. And they just kept it moving from there. Just delightful stuff.
All right, the local spinoff of that is, I didn't know this was a thing. I was late to the party, but apparently on right-wing websites and social media, this whole idea of furries spread to public schools, and that there's this whole sort of back channel communication among parents that furries are everywhere in the schools. And my guess is that this was sort of their crazy right wing reaction to transgendered kids in the schools. But it reached the point our superintendent had to be interviewed for the local newspaper to say in print, no, we don't have litter boxes in our school classrooms for students who identify as cats. That does not happen.
I remember seeing headlines to that effect. I didn't realize that was you all.
Yeah.
It might have been other districts, too, but I do remember that story because it was the kind of thing. I mean, so many of those stories are just obviously people winding each other up, you know, in Facebook groups and stuff like that. But that one I remember being struck by because sort of like, that's not a thing that like even exists that like actual furries do, as far as I know. Like, this is something that like a bunch of crackpots in Franklin, Tennessee, like made up themselves and then somehow became a problem in Bangor, Maine a month later.
Yeah.
That, what a world. We really need to, I feel like a good idea would be you should have to, like, not in the way, you know, the red flag laws, it's going to be hard to sort of implement those in the places where they need to be implemented. I think it would be safer to do it, just that you shouldn't be able to log on to any social media platform unless you can answer a few basic questions and pass a breath test.
I would be all in favor of that, absolutely. Your Mets, despite everything, hanging in there.
Yeah, they're kind of good. I've been working my way towards, being okay with that. I've been, you know, obviously I've been hurt before, as every Mets fan has. But there's something, this team feels a little bit different. I think that, especially given that, you know, so far, and I'm going to just actually knock wood before I say this, that, like, it seems like Jacob deGrom is on the right sort of trajectory to come back right after the All-Star break. Max Scherzer is already back. There's still issues with the team. But the idea of going into the back stretch of the season with DeGrom and Scherzer on top of it, I think that they will fix some of the issues that they have with their lineup just offensively. They certainly have the money to do it, and I think that this year they seem to be committed in a way that they haven't been in some time. But just having those two guys there, even if they didn't improve the lineup, I think makes them you know, a team that theoretically could win the World Series, which, I mean, I don't know when the last time I felt like I could say that about the Mets reasonably, including 2015 when they were literally in the World Series. There was a part of me that was just sort of like, well, this is fun, but don't expect anything.
Interesting discussion on the podcast this week about what you referred to as the bifurcation of particularly college football, the big time ranks. It looks like we're headed for maybe a couple of super conferences, one where they pretend that academics is important and one where they're just right up front about it.
Yeah, that is kind of the, I mean, I guess in some ways it makes sense that that would be what it would come down to, because, I mean, the Big Ten has this sort of self-image, the whole like legends and leaders pomposity. And I guess what you can say for the SEC is that they don't pretend to care about that.
Right.
That like what they care about is like calling into Paul Feinbaum's radio show, waiting on hold for 90 minutes and then crying about Michigan State football or Mississippi State football. And that's fine. You know, like that's, everybody's got their own things. I'm not going to kink shame SEC fans here on the radio in Maine, but the idea of like a 22 team Big Ten conference or, you know, a version of the SEC that includes Arizona State or whatever is just, it's bizarre enough to be kind of funny to me still. I do feel like once the dust settles and we're left with maybe three conferences, all of which are effectively so big that not every team can even play each other over the course of a year, then, you know, I don't know who exactly benefits from that. I mean, I do know who benefits from that. That, like, there's big TV deals, so, you know, administrators and, you know, the people that get paid $750,000 to, like, run the Sugar Bowl, all of those people will make money off of it. I don't know exactly what it offers fans exactly, and it sure seems clear to me that it's not any good for the players. I mean, the idea, I know they're not doing it for basketball reasons, but when the Big Ten incorporates USC and Rutgers has to go play in Los Angeles on a Tuesday night and then right. fly back, it's hard to say that that's, it, you know, it doesn't do much for me, although I probably will watch the basketball game because I'm an idiot. But those kids shouldn't have to fly 6.5 hours to go, you know, lose to Andy Enfield's team. Like, what do you get from that?
Yeah, I wonder, too, in football, and I've thought this for a while, whether you won't see a situation where those lower-level FBS conferences, the Sun Belt and Conference USA, whether they end up combining with the elite FCS conferences like Maine's, the CAA, the Big Sky, the Missouri Valley, and all those, and become sort of a second tier. Like this year, I'm broadcasting Maine games. We open up in Albuquerque, New Mexico against the Lobos, who are terrible, and Maine's got a pretty good chance to maybe go out there and win that game. There's not a big difference between the upper echelon FCS teams and those bottom of the pack FBS teams.
Yeah, there isn't. And I think that that's sort of, if there's anything good that comes out of this, I think it's not for necessarily the players or the teams in the big conferences. I guess you could say that it's better for them because, you know, as Ben Mathis-Lilly pointed out on the podcast, that it's like, effectively, if you're Michigan, you're replacing Middle Tennessee State on your schedule with UCLA, like, which is, you know, that's good for fans. For fans of teams in those smaller conferences, though, that, like, if they can just sort of detach themselves from the, like, the big money apparatus at the very top of the sport and work on actually delivering something that is, you know, maybe just a better product, then, you know, that I think could be a win. It's just hard because I think that there is, and this is the real sort of bifurcation in it, is that like there's $1 billion TV contracts for some. And then, you know, when you're dealing with CAA teams, that it's, you know, at that point you just get what you can get. And especially, you know, in a world of where there's austerity everywhere under that $1 billion class, where these are, you know, these are public universities, then, you know, it's hard to, you'd have to get really creative to get through that without seeing a sort of a diminished product, I think.
All right, I've waited till the end to bring this up. What does it mean that the best option out there in the world of politics for the Republican Party is Ron DeSantis, whose claim to fame is he's Trump without all of the baggage?
So, I mean, in some ways, I guess the only difference, I think, between DeSantis and Trump really is that DeSantis, like, seemed like a guy that tried hard in school. That, like, Trump is way weirder than just about anybody else in the United States. And DeSantis is, like, in a lot of ways, a perfectly bog-standard Republican. Like, he's just kind of a weird little weaselly Harvard guy in a suit that doesn't fit right. There's a lot of those out there. The difference, I think, is that he's willing to apply himself, like, I think he would have, had there been a different standard bearer for the party, and if it was like Mitt Romney's party, Ron DeSantis would be saying exactly the same things that Mitt Romney is saying. But as it is, because there is this like deranged fey real estate tycoon with fascist characteristics setting the pace for that party, then DeSantis is just going to do that. But because he's a grind, and because he is a guy who's chasing an A, he's actually going to follow through on it in a way that I think that Trump really couldn't or wouldn't. And, I mean, like, Trump was serious about what he was serious about, but all he was really serious about was himself. I mean, I think that, like, the idea, like, he would tip over every institution that holds up American civil society just so he wouldn't have to admit that he got his ass beat by Joe Biden in an election. But it wasn't because he had, like, unfinished business in the White House. No. He just couldn't handle it.
Exactly.
Whereas I think that DeSantis does have a program, and it is, like, strikingly anti-human and cruel. And I think that he actually, would want to follow through on it. How he somehow winds up seeming like the less dangerous of those two guys is something that whatever. Obviously, we'll have plenty of time to think and talk about.
Well, so let me ask you this, and I hate to end on a serious note, but how do we, as I think relatively normal, right-thinking people in America, how do we stay positive in the face of all that's going on, a radical court, a minority exerting ridiculous power because we have a completely incompetent majority?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, I think that the challenging part about it for me, and I mean, I wish I could just give you an answer right off the top of my head. I have not had a good time staying positive with it. I've had a really difficult time thinking about any of it. I think that the short answer that I can give you is that, like, the stuff that works at the local level, you know, and not just necessarily in terms of elected politics, but just in terms of the way that people mostly are, that is still there. So building with people, working with people, that, like, you know, in terms of, for me, I mean, the thing that I relied on when I was still, you know, working in union shops at, like, the various different sites that I've been at was feeling like just finding some place where you can feel like you can build power and advocate for the things that are important to you. And that is necessarily going to be a smaller scale, you know, and finding that spot, wherever it is and however it works, whatever, like, sort of community you can find and try to improve, that's important. I mean, I think it seems like the most important thing. The hardest part about it, though, is that it doesn't feel like enough. And I think that, you know, I don't know what to do with that necessarily. I mean, I feel like I've been very frustrated with the lack of urgency and presence on the part of the Democratic Party at the national level. You know, and my state, I know it's different everywhere, but I mean that in New York, it's very much machine-driven, and it's very corrupt, and it's also very unaccountable for those reasons. So that's bad. And I don't, you know, just voting isn't enough to feel good about any of that, especially because you're invariably voting, you know, it's like defensive driving, you know? Like, you can feel
right.
Like in many cases, you're really voting for anything that you're that excited about. But I do think that there's a sort of latent promise in how crappy this moment is, because I think that there's no way to be under the illusion that any of this is under command right now. You know, that, like, there are people that you can see that are doing a better job or a worse job. You know, there are governors that are effective. There's, you know, people in the House and people in the Senate that seem to be advocating forcefully and, you know, in a clear way for real things. But the rest of it doesn't work anymore. And I think it's like, if you can see what the GOP wants, and I think that that's a scary thing to see, and you can see what they're willing to do to sort of force it on everybody, even though, you know, the system that we have can't ever give them the majorities that they'd need to do it legitimately. once you get all that, then you can see what needs to be done. And it's like the doing of it is hard, and the conceiving of it is very hard, because it does require more than, you know, voting and sort of doing your duty. And I don't know exactly what shape that all will take yet. But at the very least, I feel like people are awake now. Mm. But of course, it's like, you know, it's scarier when you're awake, because you know you're not dreaming. Like, and that, I wish I had an answer to that. Can I ask how you are personally bearing up with that? Like, what's working for Rich?
I think you're right. You just bring it all closer to home. And I think, too, there's... You have to get outside, and summer's good for that, and talk to people and be reminded again of what we know, but we sometimes forget that social media world is not real world, and that even the people who will sometimes say some things that make you want to clench your fists in a social media setting might also be the people who will help you out when you get a flat tire, or will help you carry that heavy box out of the grocery store. So there's more good than bad out there, and I guess I'm hanging my hat on that.
I think that's absolutely right. You know, a really good point that I saw somebody make about social media the other day, because I also have found it, when I'm here and I'm on it, it's deranging. And when I was in Maine and I was carrying boxes around, I wasn't looking at my phone, and I felt better just for the removal of that, just addition by subtraction. But the other point that I saw about it that I thought made sense is that, you know, absorbing bad news through social media, which is mostly what, I mean, I do with it. Bad news is most of the news that we have. But that it's the part of it that is worse. And, I mean, obviously the news itself can be very bad. But also you're getting it after it happens. Like, you are not seeing what's coming next. You're just watching this churn as stuff gets sort of pushed further out of the cycle, further out of mind by some other bad new thing, which is always coming. And that is like, it's like trying to drive by looking in the rearview mirror, you know, like you can't see that, like, there are things that haven't happened yet. And those are going to be the things that are going to matter one way or the other. And this tendency to sort of focus on the bad things that either, you know, as they happen or that have just happened, it's not just that it's unhelpful, you know, because you can't make them unhappen, but it's like, it's bad for you. It's just going to make you feel bad. I need to do a better job taking my own advice on that, but I think that's something I'm going to try to sort of focus on, the touching grass agenda for the summer.
I'm feeling better already, and if all else fails, I'm going to dress up like a Siamese cat.
Wait, what? How bad could it be? Right. At the very least, you know that Bob Uecker will accept it.
Exactly. David, always a treat to talk with you. Thank you, my friend. We'll do it again soon.
Appreciate you, man. Thanks very much. Hang in there.